Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host Gwyn Scheltemer, and our guest this week, Anthony DiNardo. Each week, we visit with a regional author, editor, journalist, teacher, broadcaster, or someone otherwise involved in the world of words. We hope to find out a little about his life, what prompted him to start writing, and indeed to keep going, give him an opportunity to read some of his work for us, and we're very pleased to have Anthony DiNardo in the studio with us today. Welcome, Anthony.
Hello.
Anthony DiNardo was born in Montreal and is the author of four collections of poetry. His most recent, Skylight, was published this fall by Ronsdale Press. His writing career began as a journalist, publishing and editing a weekly newspaper in northwestern Ontario. Work from previous collections has been translated into both French and Italian and appears in several anthologies. His first book, Alien Correspondent, was nominated for the Acorn Plantos People's Poetry Prize and the Relip Award. He has been shortlisted for the Malahat Review's Long Poem Contest, and in 2017 he won Exile's the Gwendolyn McEwan Prize for Best Suite of Poems. He divides his time between Sutton, Quebec and Cobourg, Ontario. So let's start with some of the larger questions,
sure,
Anthony.
Sure.
What is the function of poetry for you as a poet and for your readers as you understand it?
Well, Felicity, first off, I'd like to say thank you for inviting me to this program, and I look forward to sharing my interests and my excitement with poetry.
Good.
Insofar as the function of poetry, I sort of understand poetry as the bearing of witness. I see myself as a consummate observer, and I also see poetry as an opportunity for framing experience, the experience often being the writing of the poem itself. The great American poet John Ashbery, who sadly just recently passed away, said, "I write with the intention of expressing a meaning that I couldn't put into words until I've done so by writing it in the poem." And that definitely applies to me as well. As far as its function, poetry for me is first and foremost an art form. And as such, its function is to represent ideas and experience, to distill and illuminate, and finally, I hope, to entertain. I would like to think that people read poetry because they love language, as much for its sounds and appearance on the page as for the weight that the words can bear. I personally often turn to poetry for the pleasure, the mere pleasure, of immersing myself in a compression of ideas, images that surprise and images that allow for what I call mental digressions.
You said that writing is not only making story, but making language. Poetry is good at doing that, constantly refining the art of making language. Could you elaborate on that a little?
Sure. Poetry is not only making language, but remaking it as well. As I've said, I think of poetry as an art form, and its primary medium, of course, is language. 100 years ago, the often quoted modernist poet Ezra Pound said, "Make it new." Poetry has always been renewing our language, not only by using common speech patterns, but by taking risks with diction and with syntax, by reinventing, even subverting, how language is used to represent ideas and to conceive them. For hundreds of years, poems were expected to rhyme, were structured by specific rhythms and metrics. They were crafted that way to both elevate and celebrate how language, as an art form, makes us human. And poets continue to write poems that rhyme with wonderful rhythms and wonderful meter. I'm still fascinated by the precision of a sonnet, and I still try to explore that form in my own work. But language can also dehumanize and deconstruct, even declutter our lives. Free verse, concrete poetry, erasures, lists, spoken word, fragments, fractals, thought bubbles, these forms bring unique possibilities to how we use words. By giving themselves license to experiment and take risks, poets go beyond traditional forms, mm-hmm, and stretch the limits of language.
So can you tell us a little about your poetic process and how you craft your poems? You said that sometimes you let your poems break the rules, but what rules did you have in mind here?
Well, of course, the rules of grammar and that of diction, rules of syntax, but also the rules of common sense, the rules of given reality. I'm very much attracted to the surreal and to the absurd, and I think that often features in my own work. I like to play with ideas, and of course, when you play, you either make the rules or reject them altogether. I'm very sensitive, as I've alluded to the aesthetics of language, from what words look like on the page to how they sound, to managing broken lines and fragments in a lyric. I think I thrive on the possibilities that metaphors offer, on the mind shock of an unexpected image. I love unexpected imagery. And sometimes I think there is nothing more beautiful than a complete sentence. Some of my poems are one long sentence, clause after clause, one embedded into the other. As far as process and craft is concerned, if you don't mind, I'd like to share a poem that I was working on when you had invited me to come to this interview.
Well, we'd love to hear it. Okay. Thank you.
I call it In a Typical Poem, and it really is just a snapshot as to process. Here it is. In a typical poem, I start with the title and wait for something to happen. If nothing happens, I look up from the page and see if there's something there to give me an idea. I am never done, never alone. The light moves from side to side, or there's a fold in a curtain I've never noticed before. For me, the best place to write a poem is on a bench by a tree or next to a window. I have the entire world at my fingertips. If I want, I can make things up that aren't even there. For example, that fold in a curtain, or you as a reader.
I love the end of that.
Thank you. Thank
you. Oh, dear. So how about now reading to us a little more formally from one of your collections? Or you're going to read from Skylight,
I'll read
so
from
that's great.
Yes, okay. Yes, I'd love to. Okay. One of the first poems in the book from the suite called Opus Erectus is called Autumn. And, of course, it's quite the appropriate season for reading about autumn. Autumn sets up a tripod. The trees strip down. Mountains where once there were none. I walk ablaze with old romantics, rendering under heaven cause to be awed by this dominant absence of leaves, something entirely meant for me. I'm sucked in by the barren beauty of the missing and gone, a last-minute lark in the branches. Here, when everyone else has left, sings a sorry jingle I know well. Soil in the garden boxes rotting, cold and wet, dead and wishing for winter. As for me, it's the sun and its heat today, 1st of November, that keeps me working. Hanging up leaves, ironic, neurotic, forgetful, pressings and opinions written on the backs of these trees. There is a sequence in the book called Fool Hen. A fool hen is a spruce grouse, nickname for a spruce grouse, a bird that you'll find in the mountains of Sutton, Quebec.
Oh, yeah.
And this one happened to come and invade our home one day. Stuck around for an entire day and gave me a whole whack of poems. Ooh. Here's one of them, Portrait of a Grouse. How to pick up pink without a brush. Stitch an open wound with just a beak. She makes house calls, tears down walls. She's blinded, she's broken winded. She's in the room, thrumming through. She's footloose, flight lost, answers to fool hen. A dust of dawn on feathers, autumn on her palate. She's half the sun, the other half moonlight bristling on her gown. She's totally Norval Morisot about size and sorrow. She's fingers trembling, fat thighs on the couch. Leaves blend, browns patch. She goes without, comes within, paints a portrait of herself entirely without wings. And here's another one, which is a sonnet called Fool Hen Sonnet. My lucky day, my feathered find, my kindred and found, now gone well beyond the woodland spawn, where once in fattened leaves you lived, hemlock cones and needles in the ferns, the thick and lambent burial ground of ample woodland maples, wetlands winter brown, pine nets lifting, bending, marked with tamaracks. That's where you, full hen, lived in autumn leaves and lowland boughs that tipped the ground beneath, and in that place you rested, nested, dug in nodes of wintry waste, like thoughts towed gently towards a skyward heave. You're all the woodland grace I need.
That's great. That's wonderful. It's an unusual sonnet.
Thank you. Another section is called May, June, July, and this one deals mostly with cycles of life and death in a gardenscape.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of references to flowers and to aspects of nature that you would normally find, of course, in a gardenscape. This one's called Cowslip. The cowslip, such a slight thing, leans into the slope of a draw, a common flower, commonly in view, as just another bankside beauty that runs full tilt towards oblivion. Rose. Imagine given to naming flowers, stones, the bones in a bag, bark on a tree, the pedigree of dogs, darkness, the stars one by one illuminating the names given them on a pair of lips, the tongue lacquered with a shade of pink. We've named Rose. This one's called Entangled. Cancer. There is no other word for it. Cancer. Can't kill the cherry, clematis, the crane's bill, can't kill the willow, nor the side of the house where sunlight props up the lily, the blight, and the ivy entangled. The creek. The chuckle of the creek behind the house, back bent in the rock, rock bent back in its coursing through, bend by bend to the silt at the bottom of the pond, where it stows a basic element, iron cold, iron clad. The great green, also touching on that terrible theme of cancer.
Mm.
I'm sorry, sir, your garden, sir, is in the final stages. It has 3 months to live. Insensitive as we are to the fallen branch, the garden compensates. Living things do die. A cell is banished. There's withering and there's wilt. I'm sorry, sir. You can't, sir. Your brain is in the final stages. You have 3 months to live, sir. Great green network, expanding universe, meadows growing, the good wind blowing. We're surprised, the wiring, the great green brain to wane. I'm sorry, sir. Yes, you can, sir. Feel that way. Feel such beauty shouldn't lose its mind. A flower fades. The garden wastes away. An image takes the place of what was left behind. A talking tree. A talking tree. In the language of dead leaves.
Thank you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Anthony. So now we'll take a short break.